Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the deals podcast where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Satiraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us today Steve Berg, partner at Stride Consumer Partners. Steve is part of the founding team at Stride and is closely involved with the firm's investments in Jenny's Ice Cream, Odell, Patrick Ta, and more. He's here to talk to us about the firm's investment strategies and the state of consumer M&A in 2024. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me, Nikita.
Great. So let's start with talking a little bit about your career and how you came about to starting Stride.
Sure. So I've been doing this since before The Deal was first published. I actually looked it up. First published in 1999. So congratulations on your 25th anniversary. I started off in private equity in 98 at Bain Capital. I was at Bain Capital for 4 years and then moved over to a firm called Castanea Partners that launched in 2002, was a partner there for 17 years, doing exactly what we've been doing at Stride. And eventually the founding partners of Castanea decided to retire. So a bunch of us founded Stride back in, you know, depending on who you ask, late 2019, early 2020, to continue to do the same thing we were doing. We loved the job. We felt like we were having a lot of success and had a lot of confidence in our strategy. And we really liked working together. So there are now 8 of us from Castanea who are on the Stride team.
That's fantastic. So let's talk a little bit about Stride's investment strategy and what you typically look for. Obviously want to come back to the story of starting a firm and raising a fund during the pandemic.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about what's on Stride's checklist for investments.
Sure. So our focus is growth equity. We are industry specialists investing in consumer, and we are investing in what we call passion brands, the brands that the consumer can't live without. And what we're doing is we are finding in the areas of consumer in which we focus, those young emerging brands that, despite not being around for a long time, have really generated a tremendous amount of passion and loyalty among their following. And then we're investing alongside the founders and management teams of those brands to help them grow, help them expand their reach without diminishing any of the magic that made them so special to begin with. And we're doing that with the hopes of being the most knowledgeable, resourceful, helpful, supportive partners that a founder and management team can have. You know, there's a tremendous amount of capital out there available, and we think that our chance to be chosen as a partner for the brands we're most excited about is to really offer up a partnership that is more of a service provider model than a capital provider model.
Absolutely. And there are certain subsectors in which you play that most of your brands fall under. Can you talk a little bit about those and what you look for?
Absolutely. So in order to be knowledgeable and resourceful, you can't cover the whole landscape of consumer. It's just too darn broad. And so we focus on 4 subsectors: food and beverage, beauty and personal care, active and outdoor, and multi-unit services. And really, by being that narrowly focused, we can spend more time, have more pattern recognition, have more resources, really live in those sectors as opposed to just invest in them. And so those are the areas where we spend all of our time and attention.
And was that a result of everyone's expertise and previous experience, or were there certain trends that you saw in those sectors that kind of made them the perfect fit?
So a little bit of both. We found that, and this is going back 15 years, we found that the more we focused, the more specialized we became, the easier it was. You know, just a lot easier to look at your 10th prestige skincare brand than your first one to try to figure out whether it has all the attributes that you're looking for. And so we started becoming much more and more specialized. And one of the benefits was it then made sense to bring in additional resources. And for us, that meant operating partners. So for all of those verticals, we have industry experts who are on the Stride team, and not the kind of arm's length relationship, but are very much ingrained in everything we do, that are part of what we're allowed to do because we are so focused, because we know we're going to spend so much time in beauty and personal care our partner, Nicole, who spent 24 years at L'Oreal before joining Stride, has a full plate of things to work on and brings expertise and resources to the partnerships that really are a tremendous amount of help.
And could we put a little bit about your investment parameters into context in terms of the recent investments you've made, maybe, or even some of your older ones that you work closely with, Odell being one of them? I'd love to start there and a little bit about what drew you to the brand, how the deal came about.
So the first thing with all of them is about differentiation. And so it starts with product differentiation and really having something that is new to the consumer that resonates, that drives all that loyalty. And then making sure that that is paired with a brand that really means something, where for the consumer, it's not just a transaction or a utilitarian purchase. It's really something that goes much deeper than that in order to generate the emotion and the passion that we're looking for. And so whether you're talking about Jenny's Ice Cream or Odell or Patchertal, with all of them, that's where we started. And with Odell in particular, for us, the differentiation was this was a brand that was bringing a very powerful combination of clean ingredients and real functional benefits to hair care, but doing it at a price point that was much more accessible. You know, we spent a lot of time in prestige beauty, and there are a number of brands, whether it's in hair care or skincare in particular, Skinfix is a great example, that have figured out how to merge clean ingredients with real efficacy. But in a price point that Odell is, it's not very common. And so you had a movement towards clean, but it turned out it was clean without a lot of functional benefit, without a lot of efficacy. Well, they have both. And that's what's really resonating with the customer. But then they also had a positioning that was different and really stood out and resonated with that masstige consumer. It was a positioning that was very similar to what we are used to in the prestige space. And then you couple that with founders, in the case of Odell, three founders who are on a mission. It's one of the reasons that we invest behind founder-led brands is because those founders bring something special. They tend to be the keeper of the flame when it comes to that brand and to the product quality. They're the ones that are most fiercely defending product quality, making sure that the differentiation is always there. But they're also the ones that are guiding that strategy to take over the world. And so in Odell, it was the complete package. Same thing, Patchertal. Patrick himself is an incredibly authentic founder. He's a very accomplished, high-profile makeup artist. And when we looked at Patchertal, we weren't actually all that interested in color cosmetics at the time because we thought it was missing those ingredients. There'd been a wave of entrants into color cosmetics that were launched by these different influencers, social media influencers. And so those influencers who had a huge following came to market, but they were all going to the same labs. And so they were bringing product that wasn't differentiated. It was all the same stuff. And then there wasn't really authenticity and authority in the brand either, because while they had a huge following, they weren't really of the makeup industry. Patrick is the complete opposite. He's a makeup artist who launched his brand and chose what products to launch based on what he was actually using in his makeup artistry practice. And we felt like that was something that was very different relative to what was on the market. We felt like the consumer would resonate with that authority and that authenticity. And then Patrick is absolutely maniacal about product quality. Their quality is fantastic. I'm not a user, but I know from talking to many, and Nicole is a true expert, that just the performance of the product stands out. And so that's what we're really looking for in all the brands. And I could go on, whether it's Chomps and Pete and Rashid, the two founders of Chomps, their maniacal focus on product quality. That's something that you would find in any brand that we invest in.
Absolutely. And I do want to talk about Chomps and Jenny's Ice Cream, because I think they fall under the food as well as the multi-unit category in Jenny's case. So maybe if we could start with Chomps and then talk about Jenny's.
Yeah, absolutely. Another example of, we don't particularly love the product category. So my partner Juan Marcos is the person at Stride who's working with Chomps, and he would tell you the meat snacks category was not one that he wanted any part of. But as he heard about Chomps and started looking at their results and then tested the product, he kind of begrudgingly became convinced that, hey, this is different. You know, there had been some other brands in meat snacks that had been not successful for a time and then not very successful. And that had really caused us to shy away. But here was Chomps that was breaking a lot of the rules. They were coming forth with a truly better quality product. This is grass-grazed beef. This is no sugar. This is really high quality ingredients. And a brand that was had a far broader appeal. It's a brand that, and I'll get the statistic wrong, so I won't quote it specifically, but more than half the customers are female. Highly, highly unusual in the meat snacks category. And then led by two founders with very authentic stories. And as I mentioned before, just absolutely maniacal about product quality, which is also one of the issues in the category is within the beef jerky category, the inconsistencies within the product, one batch great, next batch not. Pete and Rashid had figured that out through painstakingly just refining and refining and refining. So same sort of story there. Very excited to invest behind them and take an incredibly loyal following and then expand that carefully through expanded distribution, through expanded marketing reach, et cetera.
The interesting bit about their customer demographic, how did that happen? Like, what was different about their marketing, or was it just their product? How did they end up with like majority female customer demographic?
A mix of both. You know, a product that was, because it was consistent, you didn't have to be dedicated to the category to love the product. If you look at the ingredients, it's a very clean ingredient deck. The zero sugar is hugely impactful to that broader audience. And when we did the research, we found that most of the customers that they were acquiring weren't switching from other meat snacks. They're just switching from other snacks. They're switching from chips, from popcorn, from bars. And then it's a marketing message that is much more inclusive, that is not just focused on a narrow demographic. It doesn't have a message that would be hard for certain folks to associate with. It's a very healthy message, and that resonates broadly. In fact, the comment that I most get when I mention Chomps to people is, most recently, a few people in a row, oh, my kids eat a ton of that. And so it's also a brand that is something that parents feel comfortable giving to their kids, which speaks both to the nutritional qualities, but also to the brand positioning and how accessible it is.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about Jenny's as well. That's, I know you have great stories there.
Yeah, it's hard to just tell you a little.
Tell me a lot then.
Okay. I mean, that, what a passion brand. You know, if anyone says, give me the definition of passion brand, Jenny's is one of those that I immediately point to, because if I tell someone that we're involved in any way with Jenny's and they know the brand, undoubtedly, without fail, first thing someone says is they tell me their favorite flavor. Can't wait to tell me, like, oh my gosh, gooey butter cake is to die for. Or they'll go on and on about, well, my favorite originally, which was goat cheese and cherries. And so generating that sort of a response, that sort of an emotional, I can't wait to tell you about this product, is what we're looking for in all the brands that we invest. That's a business. Jenny herself is absolutely amazing. James Beard, award-winning chef, who conceived of the brand, created the brand, is still that North Star for the brand in terms of the product quality. It is truly, it's an indulgent product. If you look at the label, you'll see it in the calorie count, but you'll also see her commitment to quality that continues on when you look at the ingredients. You know, this is a brand that uses only the best ingredients, uses grass-grazed milk, uses locally sourced product whenever possible, and has done it in a way that is incredibly creative without selling out. You know, their creativity tends to have some sort of a culinary angle to it, and that's what draws a lot of their customers. And then that's a business that we've been invested in for a long time, have watched as they have grown their store base with great success, but also managed to simultaneously grow a big business in grocery with their pints, and then more recently with their novelty products that they've just launched.
And you talked about being a knowledgeable, resourceful, operationally focused investor. I'm curious to know what shape that takes. If you could talk about that in the context of one of these investments and in generally too, I'd love to know what the value add looks like at Stride.
Sure. Founders that partner with us are generally seeking help in three areas. One is just that strategic guide. Someone who has seen the movie before, someone who has seen what happens next when a company goes from 25 to 50 to 100 million in revenue. Like, by the way, when you get about this size, expect this sort of tension within the organization. Just somebody who kind of knows what might be coming next in general, just working with brands of the size, whether it's in food or beverage or active and outdoor or what have you. The second area where a lot of folks look for help is in company building. There's either a small band of highly dedicated folks. Patrick Ta, there were less than 10 employees of the company at the time we invested. There are now, I believe, 50. And figuring out how best to grow the company, how to anticipate the needs, how to appropriately narrow people's scope so that they can focus and go deep while bringing in other talent, but making sure that you don't lose that magic, that you don't get folks too siloed, that the founders find a role where they limit the list of things they're doing that they don't enjoy or where they don't have a special talent, and we maximize the time spent exercising their superpowers. So that is a huge, huge area of emphasis for us because it's so important in companies of this size. They are the size of the team 4 years later is going to be a multiple of what it was when we first invested. And then the last area is that big bucket, which is the specific expertise, which can be either industry expertise. Hey, what gross margin threshold should I be aiming for if I want to be competitive within prestige skincare? Or how do I think about sequencing the conventional grocery accounts that I want to add in food and beverage so that I maintain my momentum and perform as well as I can? And then there's the other part of that, that's kind of the industry specialist part about being in beauty for 25 years or food and beverage for 25 years. But then there's also the functional expertise that cut across all of them. And it tends to be mostly in marketing and revenue driving, because whether it's beauty or food or active, it's all about building that brand and getting the word out. And so like we do in each of the industry sectors, we have operating partners that are full-time at Stride who are focused on those revenue driving functions. And that could be help me come up with an optimized media plan to support my brand campaign. It could be help me revamp my website. It could be help me launch on Amazon and go from initially a defensive strategy to a more revenue generating strategy. We actually, one of the things we've done over the 20 plus years is we've kept track of the questions we've been asked, because they tend to be the same ones. You know, whether you're food or your beauty or your color cosmetics or skincare, there's some commonalities. And so the way that we try to refine our own strategy, our own capabilities, by keeping track of what are those questions or requests that have come from CEOs and founders, and are we resourceful and helpful and responsive for all of them? Do we either know the answer, have an example, one phone call away from a trusted outside party to provide the help, whatever it is, and making sure that if there is something that's been asked that we weren't able to provide the help to the level we would want, well, let's go find it. Let's go figure that out. Let's go figure it. And in the past, that led us to bringing in different operating partners. It led us to, hey, let's go find the third party expert that knows TikTok shop cold, because we're starting to get asked about that, whatever it is.
That's really interesting. And that was going to be one of my questions, is that do you always have your operating partners like in-house, or do you bring people specific to a investment that are there only for the lifetime of that investment?
We try to do as much in-house as we possibly can. That includes our operating partners. They have a different title, but their role is darn similar. And we like to say, if you were in on one of our Monday meetings, it'd be hard to differentiate who's technically an operating partner versus more of a traditional investing partner background, because they are so ingrained. So as much in-house as possible, because that helps the rest of us learn from them, so that we all become these hybrids, so that I'm better able to recognize an opportunity to call, oh, that's an opportunity. Let's call Sharon and bring her in, because Sharon has spent the last 7 years training me on all these capabilities within marketing, where she's the true expert. But because we work hand in hand, I'm better able to recognize when those opportunities appear. But there's limits to that. And so one of the things that our operating partners do is they go out and find those third parties and test drive them and assess them and make sure that we've got that roster, that when someone says, I want to go on Amazon, who's your third, this is what Stride's going to do. Here are three third parties that we've vetted, that we've had confidence in, and we'd be happy to help you decide which one's best for your particular situation, for example.
Got it. Hey, if you're inviting me to one of your Monday meetings, I'd love to sit in.
All off the record.
All off the record. Oh, that's totally all right. You also kind of mentioned Patrick Ta went from close to 10 to 50. I'm just curious to know over what time period that happened, over how many years, to get a sense of how quickly these brands can grow.
That's in terms of employees?
Yeah.
We've been invested in Patrick Ta for 18 months.
Oh my God. Okay. So that was quick.
And it's funny that you picked that one, because that's an outlier, but that's a stellar team. Kimberly, who runs that business, is a phenomenal CEO, and she moves quickly. And one of her great benefits in moving so quickly is she's one of these great executives that people love working for. And so if you look at who she's brought to Patrick Ta, it's folks from her background. Kimberly calls and says, hey, I have an opportunity. And their immediate reaction is, I'm in. And so that has helped her scale that business that quickly. But that would be one of the quicker builds for sure. But it does give you a sense of the scale, because even 10 to 20 or 10 to 25 is a big deal. And it requires you to start thinking about processes that maybe you didn't have to think about, and putting some structure around some things that used to be done more casually. And communication was easier because you all sat in the same room together. Well, now you're in different offices, or maybe you're in different geographies. And so a lot of that, it's not just about hiring the team. It's also about making sure that team comes together and gels.
The one thing that I didn't ask you earlier, when you're looking at brands, you mentioned obviously this isn't a really big characteristic that you're hyper-focused on, but I am curious to know if there are like certain revenue ranges or EBITDA, profitability margins, things like that you're looking at as well.
So we're really trying to get at loyalty, and loyalty expressed mostly in repeat purchase, because somebody can tell you they're loyal, but we want to see them coming back to buy again and again. And revenue we have found to not be a great measure of that loyalty for two reasons. One, heck, these days, if your relative or your next door neighbor is a social media influencer, you can go from zero to 50 million in revenue without a single repeat purchase. No loyalty. And the flip side is, if you have really narrow distribution, you might have tremendous loyalty and $10 million of revenue. So it really is not a great metric. We want to go deeper, but turns out typically 20 million plus of revenue is about the time we've generally seen that loyalty start to show up. And then when it comes to profitability, for us, we are not venture stage investors. And proven loyalty is one differentiation between venture stage and what we do. And the other one is that the economic model works. And for us, that doesn't necessarily mean profitability. If you're hemorrhaging, then that's probably a bad sign for us. You're not at the stage that we invest. But if your gross margins are where they should be relative to industry norms and thresholds, but instead of generating a ton of profitability, you're investing ahead of the growth in your team, in marketing, in building brand awareness. If it's by choice that you are break even or you're losing a little bit, that is totally fine with us. We do want businesses that by the time we're deep into our investment partnership with them are nicely profitable, have great cash flow characteristics, would be attractive not only to a strategic buyer, but to a financial buyer. But early on, when you're at that steep part of the growth curve, we do believe in investing ahead of the growth, even if it means sacrificing profitability in the short term.
Got it. And you mentioned distribution. That kind of reminded me of when you were talking about all the operational support that you provide. I'm just curious to know, in terms of manufacturing, the contract manufacturing, and all of those bits, could you talk a little bit about how that works from your value add as well?
Absolutely. So give you examples from the beauty industry because I'm a little bit closer to that. We do have relationships with labs and we do know a lot of them, even if we're not in a direct relationship by virtue of reputation or having seen them work with other companies. We also have third parties that we've worked with over and over again to really assess labs in terms of the quality and being able to consistently deliver that quality, but also in terms of what the economics of that relationship should look like, either initially or over time as they scale. And so we do spend a lot of time. PetraTa is a great example. They had a very outsource-driven sourcing and supply chain model that served them incredibly well from a product quality perspective when they were quite small. We're helping them, and the COO at PetraTa is one of Nicole, my partner's former colleague, so she helped find him. He's very strong, and we're partnering with them to really look at that supply chain as they've scaled now in terms of making sure that that not only is the quality there, absolutely have to maintain that, but that the economics make sense. And then the same thing on the distribution side. My partner, Juan Marcos, who spends a lot of time in food and beverage, has a real in-depth understanding of the differences between conventional grocers. And I think of conventional grocers as pretty darn similar. But when you're talking about a new brand, different grocers have different consumer profiles, have different track records in terms of the ability for new brands, more health conscious brands, you know, and he would tell you that retailer A is where you want to go first, not retailer B, because retailer A reaches the demographic that's more similar to where you're having success today, will help you expand gradually, where retailer B is a completely different demographic and much more of a risk and a leap. And so that knowledge that he has of being able to help brands understand that these two different retailers coming to you and offering you shelf space, you're making a very different bet depending upon which one of them you're thinking about going to next, and that there's a real power and a strategy in that sequencing in order to build that momentum. Go here when your awareness may still be low because that retailer already has that customer of yours. Wait until your broader awareness is higher before you go into this other retailer, which tends to have a different demographic base.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I never thought about it like that before. And the other thing that I did miss out on asking you sooner is how do you source your deals? You know, you're obviously looking for passion brands. Like how do you, is most of it proprietary? Are you going through investment bankers, brokers? I'm curious to know a little bit about that.
All the above. So one of the benefits about being focused is that you can spend the time going deep to understand who's out there. Because we got to figure out who's out there in only four subsectors. But we do everything from walking retailers to mining social media data to talking to different industry participants. The ideas kind of come from a whole bunch of areas. Once they kind of become ideas and we have a point of view on them in terms of how do we actually make that connection, it's also a variety. Investment bankers are incredibly helpful to us and we find they do a great service because we've built relationships and have credibility with them, and they help relay that to the founders we're talking about and help those founders differentiate among the different firms they're talking to because we all sound the same. But those investment bankers tend to have a really good sense of where the important differences lie. But we also find that we get connected via retailers who say, hey, here's an interesting brand. I'd really love to see them do well, but they've got some stuff they need to iron out. Would love to see them with a partner who could help them really improve how they operate, how they grow the market, what have you. And then we're just reaching out to folks ourselves and trying to make that initial contact and have a conversation, which may lead nowhere. But for us, we get a kick out of those first conversations. I mean, you get to hear some great founder stories. Like, how on earth did you decide to launch Chomps? Why, when you were in this completely other industry, did you decide that you had to come over here and do this completely differently? And there's often a really personal story, at least with the ones that we get excited about. If it's someone who says, well, I was interested in performance marketing and I saw gross margins were really high in the beauty industry, that's not a brand that we're going to get excited about because there's no passion there. But when someone says, hey, I struggled my whole life with eczema and couldn't find something that worked for me. And so I decided to create it. Or I had a kid who had a sensitivity to X, Y, or Z in food and couldn't find what I was looking for. And so I just decided to do it. Or I decided the world needs to be a better place and here's how I'm going to make it that, because I'm on that mission. And so when you talk about sourcing, part of what's so fun for us is, regardless of whether it turns into anything in terms of an actual opportunity for Stride, there's just some great, great stories out there of entrepreneurs taking these amazing leaps and creating something amazing and then having an unbelievable amount of passion to take over the world. It's a lot of fun.
For sure. And once you've had these brands, you've grown them, and time comes for exits, not saying that you're looking for anything right now, but in the past, a lot of your exits of like really great brands like First State Beauty and like Tatcha and Urban Decay have been to strategics, large companies, Unilever, P&G, what have you. So I'm curious to know like who your typical buyer is on the other end of it. Is it usually strategics or have you had PE in there as well?
It's both, but it's been predominantly strategics by design. One of the things that we do, even before we finalize an investment, is we work with the management team to come up with a strategic plan. And it really starts with, what do you want that outcome to be? And then let's describe this business 4 or 5 years from now that aligns with that outcome. And let's describe it. Yeah, we're going to describe the revenue. We're going to describe the profitability. Sure. But let's describe the brand. Let's describe the product offering. Let's describe the distribution. Let's describe the team and really put together something specific. And one of the benefits, again, of being so focused and having sold a number of brands to the large food and beverage companies, to the large beauty businesses, what have you, is you do tend to know what that ought to look like in order to maximize success. And so that design then feeds the strategic plan all the way back to what are we going to do next quarter? It is, to some degree, aiming at that strategic acquirer. So if we're going to gain a bunch of market share in beauty, let's then talk to L'Oreal and Estee Lauder and Unilever down the road. But at the same time, we don't want to be limited by that. So let's create a great strategic asset, but let's also create a great business with great cash flow characteristics. Because if we're doing our job really well, when it comes time to think about an exit, we want all those strategics to be incredibly excited. We also want the private equity firms to be looking at it and say, hey, I'd love to be invested in this business. And when you look at what our exits have been, so we recently sold from the Castanea portfolio, Yasso, which was a dessert business, to Unilever. A number of the private equity firms were very competitive up until the very end of the process. That's our measure of success. Is this a business that is both really attractive as a strategic asset, but also has a great financial profile that you're interested in both? And then the timing of that exit for us is really about where do you come to a strategic fork in the road for a business? So I'll give you an example from way, way back. We were investors in a brand called Fuse Beverage. And Fuse had done a great job and had really a tremendous trajectory by virtue of getting more and more distribution and getting on more and more shelves. There came a time where they had run out that string and were on not every, but starting to get close to every shelf they wanted to be on. And so the engine of growth was going to go from being both distribution and velocity gains to just velocity gains, which required a lot more consumer-facing marketing, which was a capability that really wasn't that strong within that business at that time. And so that was a fork in the road. You either say, okay, let's see if now is a good time for exit and if the value is there, or double down, spend a couple of years developing this new capability, proving it out, and exit at that time. Same thing for Urban Decay when they had reached pretty full distribution in North America. We had proven the concept internationally, but we hadn't really gone fully into international distribution. That was a fork in the road. And at that time, we decided, okay, let's test and see if we've created as much value as we think we have. Or should we take on this next chapter of growth ourselves? In the case of Fuse, Coca-Cola ended up being the acquirer. And in the case of Urban Decay, it was L'Oreal.
Got it. How many years was the Fuse and Urban Decay growth till you got to that fork in the road?
I want to Fuse. Oh, you're testing my memory. I want to say Fuse was 4 years and Urban was just under 4 years.
Got it. I want to talk a little bit more broadly about consumer M&A and what that's been like. Obviously, last year was pretty slow. I'm curious to know what your deal flow is like this year, like what you're seeing broadly in terms of companies coming to market and the kind of valuations they're expecting.
Yeah, it's been weird. I think we're on quarter number 8 of being told that next quarter is going to be really good. You're right in that last year was slow. We did make an investment in Odell at the end of the year. And I think that's a good example of the deal flow that we're seeing. They did not hire an investment banker. They talked to a number of people, but it wasn't a classic process. Same thing with Patrick Ta. Same thing for Serenity Kids, which we recently just invested in, where it was more of a conversation with founders. And so we have found our deal flow actually to be lower in absolute numbers, but the quality of the conversations is higher because they tend to be founders who are not trying to time the market in terms of when I raise capital. They're founders who are saying, I really want and need a partner. A lot of folks are waiting on the sidelines. But the ones that we're having the serious conversations with and the ones that I just mentioned were all those who came to the conclusion, you know what? I'm passing up opportunities right now in terms of building my team, expanding my distribution, what have you. And that has real opportunity cost to me. I know it's not a market in which you run a broad process right now, or at least I'm being told that. I'm going to have some one-off conversations. And so that has led to those investments that we've made. And that seems to be more and more what's happening now. We don't see the sheer volume of banker-led processes. It tends to be more individual conversations. We're happy with either. And we feel very good about those three examples, Patrick Ta, Odell, and Serenity Kids, in terms of those partnerships. They tend to align very well, you know, what they're looking for and how we like to work. But it has been, pick your term, slow, weird, choppy. And I'd love to predict when it's going to change, but that would be the 9th quarter in a row where I thought it was next quarter.
And valuation expectations, have they kind of like recalibrated, or are they still as high as they were at the peak 2021, early 22?
You know, I don't know because we haven't seen the volume, but here's our hypothesis. Our hypothesis is that the peak, if you will, or the valuations that really got high were unusually high, were not for the A-plus companies. It was for the B-plus. And that differentiation between what an A-plus company would get valued at and a B-plus company seemed to narrow or disappear. And our point of view is we will gladly pay up, or what feels like paying up, for an absolute phenomenal brand. And the inverse is true for us as well. If the brands don't meet the standards or the hurdles for us, a lower valuation doesn't cure that in our minds. And so for us, the valuations have been, remain, and probably will always be high, because that's just our investment thesis, is let's really find those most remarkable companies. But I do think, and I've had heard and have talked to other folks in the industry, it's that B plus tier that is feeling the most significant drop. That in the earlier stage, earlier than we invest in, our understanding is that's where the valuations have contracted the most.
So would you say your pipeline is full for 2024 in terms of the deals that you're looking at?
I guess. It's weird. We're just such not a volume and statistic. You know, we looked at this many deals this year because they tend to be so specific in terms of situation. I would tell you the volume for us in the last 6 months has not been all that high, yet we've made 2 investments. And for us, 2 investments a year is pretty close to right on pace. And so I wouldn't say it's not deep in terms of sheer numbers, but we have a couple of conversations ongoing right now that we're really excited about and, you know, could turn into something down the road not far.
Absolutely.
So sorry, we're a terrible source for any sort of statistics on deal flow.
No.
We haven't found it to be a good predictor of how many investments we will actually make.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's not what I should be coming to you for anyway. I'm coming to you for like consumer confidence and consumer trends and the right brands to find. So I think I'm getting all of that from you.
Okay, good.
I think that brings me to the bit that I did ask you about in terms of the four subsectors that you invest in. If you could characterize the trends that are going on in those four subsectors that are really interesting to you, you know, with
sure.
beauty and then going to food and bev.
Yep. And I may disappoint here in that I don't think we have any hypotheses that are unique to us. We tend not to be trend-driven. We're looking for more generational shifts. And the ones we're looking at, a lot of people are looking at. So in beauty, efficacy matched with clean ingredient labels. You know, the pendulum has swung back and forth, whether you're talking about, this is mostly skincare or hair care commentary. Great efficacy, but the ingredient deck looks like a science experiment. To nice and clean and very gentle, but not sure there's anything going on. And you know, a number of brands have found that sweet spot in the middle. You know, Skin Fix, we did a market map before they ever raised capital and identified them as the single most interesting skincare brand out in the market. And we were lucky we came to that conclusion right before they started to raise capital. But they're the poster child for that mix of great clean ingredients and real science and real efficacy. And in their case, taking it so far as clinical trials and patents. That's coming to hair care, has been coming to hair care for a while. And in the case of Odele, at a more accessible price point. Color, even though we're having a fantastic partnership with Patrick Ta, I would say we're probably still a little bit, maybe choosy is the right word, extremely choosy there, and feel fortunate with the choice that we were able to make. Food and beverage, it tends to be two overriding theses. We're typically either investing behind a healthier, better for you, which would be a Chomps or a Serenity Kids, or we're investing behind a premiumization. So Jenny's, the real leader in whether you call it the super premium or ultra premium, but it's that movement that as a percentage, that price point is significantly higher than some others. But in terms of absolute dollars, it's actually not that large. And the quality and the experience is just so superior that a segment of the consumer has said, I'm going to selectively pay up for that premium product and that premium experience. So those are the two within food and beverage. Within active and outdoor, it is really about performance for us, because one of the underlying movements within active and outdoor is blurring the lines with fashion. And we think that's really interesting as a consumer. I think that's really interesting as an investor. That scares us. We love Truework. Truework is a brand that is taking all that outdoor performance wear, four-way stretch, breathable, waterproof, and bringing it to actual working gear for the trades. So as opposed to wearing Carhartt canvas, which technology is at least 100 years old. Instead of wearing that, which is heavy and worse when it gets wet and doesn't insulate very well, why not wear this high performance, real working gear? That is all about performance. And it's not about getting next season's color exactly right. And so for us, that's where the real emphasis is in active and outdoor. And in multi-unit, that's the one that has gone through the most, for obvious reasons with the pandemic, but also coming out of the pandemic, still settling down in terms of what is the new normal, if you will. But I would say we tend to like those things that are not about convincing people to adopt completely new habits, but rather have a new place to go for your old habits. And that in fitness and in beauty have been two of the things that have really been differentiators for us. We were investors in Drybar. And one of the reasons we got so comfortable is that women were getting their hair blown out. Eventually, a lot more women were, but women were still getting their hair blown out when we first invested. They were just doing it at their traditional high-end salon where the salon didn't want to do it. Or they were going to someplace that was at a much lower price point and the experience just wasn't there. And so we were taking an existing habit and making it a far superior customer experience. That we love. Convincing somebody to do something completely new that's not a part of their routine is tough for us.
And what would you say some of the other categories are for multi-unit and franchising? You touched on fitness. You said you still haven't found the brand that you want to invest in. So that's where you're actively looking?
Yes, absolutely. And we love that space. It's just a matter of finding the right fit.
And when it comes to food and restaurants, you said you lean over towards something like Jenny's, not like a sit-down restaurant.
Yeah. So part of the reason we like being specialized and going deep is that we take comfort in feeling like we know a little bit more about what we're doing. You know, maybe we have some more scars that we've learned from, and maybe we come in and it's a little bit easier to do diligence because, as I mentioned, it's the 10th prestige skincare brand, not the first or the second. Restaurant is one of those areas where we talk about it a lot. We're comfortable at the Jenny's end, which the prep is scooping ice cream out of the tub and putting it on a cone, and where the inventory is frozen and therefore has an incredibly long shelf life. And the menu is pretty simplistic. Coffee fits in there, some other treat concepts. If you start going to the other end of the spectrum, full service restaurant, we think about that. But for us, that would be an evolution where we would have to feel comfortable that we spent enough time getting smart. We spent enough time assembling the resources, the third parties, the relationships, the operating partner, all that sort of stuff, so that we can live up to our aspiration of being that knowledgeable, resourceful, helpful partner. That would be the prerequisite to going further in that direction, because otherwise we don't think it would be consistent with our strategy.
Absolutely. I do want to circle back to the beginning of our conversation and talk about raising your first fund, which you closed in 2022, if I'm not mistaken. Talk to me a little bit about what it was like in the middle of the pandemic.
Our first flight to go start fundraising was on March 10th. And by the time we touched down in San Francisco, having come from Boston, four of our five meetings were canceled. So that was a great way to get out of the gates. We then spent a bunch of time thinking about how the pandemic was going to affect the companies that we were still working with, how it was going to affect our strategy. Our answer was not really. Turns out, actually, the brands you give up last do pretty well during the pandemic. So Jenny's Ice Cream, in the 3 months that all of their shops were closed because of the pandemic, the shops historically had been 2/3 of their revenue. Jenny's revenue was up 20% year on year during those 3 months. Because people went to the grocery stores, people ordered it online. I think our online business was up 4x and our grocery store business was up 5x because people said, I want my Jenny's. So definition of a passion brand. Sims Fishing, Yasso. If you looked at all the companies we were working with, they're still held up great, which was a real testament to the strategy and gave us more confidence. But when it came to fundraising, no one at that time was willing to commit to a fund without meeting face-to-face, which you look back and you think, well, that's kind of crazy, where they wanted to see how tall we were or something. But at that time, Zoom was not enough to get a fundraising commitment. And no one was willing to meet with us if we had come off an airplane because people were being very cautious. And so we decided to bring the fundraising to them. So Tim and Juan Marcos and I, two separate times, rented a massive Sprinter van, threw coolers in the back with all our snacks and Jenny's pints and Yasso bars and everything else. The first time we drove to Chicago, stopped in Cincinnati and Indianapolis and Central Illinois, and we had fundraising meetings outdoors in public parks, in lifestyle centers. We had a meeting in somebody's backyard. We were in a public park north of Chicago having a fundraising meeting with a potential investor. And a bunch of 10-year-olds ran literally through the middle of our meeting because we were socially distanced with our ring of chairs around and we were in the middle of this park. So Tim knows the exact mileage we put on, but the first one we went to Chicago and back, second one we went to Jacksonville, Florida, and hit spots along the way and made fun of each other for our music choices. And the secret was, everyone says, oh, it's amazing that you did that. What amazing effort. You know, we'd watched entrepreneurs do stuff a heck of a lot more interesting and scrappy than that. So it was kind of like, hey, I have to emulate the folks we're partnering with. They'd be disappointed if we didn't. And then the other part is, three of us really like each other and we all had cabin fever, and a week on the road together in a road trip was not that bad. It was kind of a lot of fun.
That's a great story. Love Chick-fil-A, as you mentioned.
Oh, gosh, yes. Juan Marcos found every Chick-fil-A on the way.
Anything that I missed out on asking, either about Stride or the state of consumer M&A that you think would be an interesting thing to hit on?
Nothing where I'm going to have any insightful answers, that's for sure. We are having a lot of fun, I will tell you that. And we're having a ton of fun. It's a great group. We feel super lucky to be partnered with the folks we're partnered with. It's what we've been doing for a long time. And so we've kind of found our groove. Or hit our stride. There you go.
Hit your stride. There you go.
My partner Sharon would want me to make sure I said that. Hit our stride.
Thank you so much for a great conversation, Steve.
Oh, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
I'm Nikita Sathyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.